Warning: the following program features mature content not suitable for younger audiences.
This podcast explores subjects dealing with mature content, vulgar language, and violent scenarios.
You've been warned. Now, on to the show. Happy holidays, everyone. I'm TJ Scorpio.
And I'm GZDude13. Welcome once again to the Creepy Carousel Horror Podcast.
We hope you're having a wonderful holiday season.
And we're glad you're spending some of it with us.
As 2019 comes to an end, we'd like to look back and thank you for all the support you, our listeners, have given us.
We love creepy stories and all things horror, but more importantly, we love sharing them with you. Because of you, we're motivated to continue.
We always have a lot of fun recording and making content for the show, and we're excited for the future content we have planned for 2020.
But for now, grab your eggnog and cuddle up by the fireplace while we narrate these two holiday creepypastas just for you.
Enjoy.
Number one.
Look, I already know I ain't winning any Mother of the Year awards anytime soon, but I did my best with the cards I was dealt in life. Anyone that has to endure the life of a single parent knows that it ain't easy raising a kid all on your own. But it don't mean I didn't love my little hellion Allie. She was the reason I put up with the pervert manager at the diner. She was the reason I couldn't finish high school. She's the reason I'm going to prison very soon. But before I go, I want everyone to know the truth about what really happened. I work two jobs. My legit job as a waitress at the diner, just a few blocks down from the ghetto I call my home, and my less legal late-night job standing at the corner of the same ghetto street. Obviously, between both jobs, I don't exactly have time to be a good mother. Allie isn't a model student at school, and I know the only reason she acts out is to get my attention. But I loved her all the same. Saying that Allie was a handful was the understatement of the year. But I won't stand here and tell you she was a bad apple or a rotten kid. She just wasn't disciplined, and I have to own that. On any given day, she can be anyone's worst nightmare. But when the holidays arrive, she becomes an even bigger handful. At 8 years old, she's a very clever kid. Allie long since figured out that there's no such thing as the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, or Santa Claus. Emphasis on Santa Claus. I miss being able to get her to behave during the holidays by threatening to tell Santa that she was misbehaving. Without that leverage, and with my kid getting off school for winter vacation, I was in for a stressful holiday. Even though my little 8-year-old monster really doesn't deserve it, I usually like to try to get her something nice for Christmas. This year, though, she really tested me when she threw her plate of instant mash against the wall. I forget what we were arguing about again, but really none of that matters. I sent her to bed without dinner, and after she slammed her door, I cleaned up and got ready for another cold night meeting strangers and hopefully making enough to make rent this month. During the holidays, I can usually count on finding plenty of clientele consisting of lonely poor sobs, but tonight, the streets were empty, and the night was unusually silent. I walked home freezing in my short skirt and thin coat. It had snowed earlier in the night, and another light snow had started to fall again. As I shivered my way from one street lamp to the next, I thought I heard something off in the distance. Sounded like a child throwing a fit to me. It was well past 3 a.m, and even in this part of town, it's strange to hear a kid throwing a hissy fit at this time of night. Still, I listened as the little brat screamed his lungs off before being abruptly cut off. I assume an angry and hungover parent gave the brat a good dose of shut the hell up before going back to bed. I put the scream out of my mind and continued to make my way home. Just as I reached a cone of yellow light from the next street lamp, the world around me went dark. The street lamps went out and so did the tacky Christmas lights on the buildings and apartments around me. My initial thought was, great, just what I needed, a power outage. How the hell am I going to find my way home now? I pulled out my cheap cell phone and toggled on the flashlight app. The dim yellow light was hardly an improvement, but at least I could watch where I was going. The darkness seemed to have brought an eerie and deeper silence with it, and the chill of the night felt like it dropped another 20 degrees. Something felt wrong. I felt as if someone or something was watching from the dark. I whipped my light around, trying to see if someone was there, but the crappy cell phone light wasn't strong enough to light up more than a few feet in front of me. I strained my ears, trying to hear anything through the unnatural silence of the night, but it was so dead quiet that all I could hear was my breath and the sound of my own heart beating a million miles a minute in my chest. Just as I started to believe that all of this was in my head, I heard it. Something moved. It was the rustle of fabric along with the sound of a crunching snow. Working the streets has taught me never to go out without a weapon, so instinctively I already had my hand in my coat pocket, ready to pull out my hidden switchblade. I pointed the light towards where I heard the sound, and was startled to see a dark shadow lumbering over me only a few feet away. At first, I thought I was looking at ragged curtains just swaying in the wind right there in the middle of the street. But as I slowly pointed my light upward, I saw that it was a person, covered in long and filthy rags, stitched together to make a kind of cloak. The figure was easily between 10 to 15 feet tall. I didn't want to see more, but my arms slowly continued to shine the light upwards, towards the figure's face. The light fell short, and all I could see was darkness under the figure's hood. I can't describe exactly what I was thinking standing there, but I know exactly how I felt when the figure leaned down and let the light reveal its face. Pure, unbridled terror made me jump back and forget about the knife in my pocket. My light was weak, but it was bright enough to show me the face of an old woman. Her eyes were glazed over with a white, dead look. Black veins were the only thing I could see in her ghostly stare. Her face was masked by wrinkles and warts brought on by centuries of weathering. Her mouth was unnaturally wide, and her jaw moved as she silently chewed on something. Her entire face was pale gray, which made the blood staining her mouth seem unrealistically bright. She leaned forward towards me until her face was only a foot away from the light in my hand. I could smell the iron copper smell of the blood on her face, and I thought I would gag, but instead, I remained frozen in place. She continued to chew, and I heard a crunch and snap as her teeth broke apart whatever she was mulching up, followed by a deep swallow. Her head slowly cocked sideways as she looked at me, first to the left, then to the right, and then she tilted her head back and closed her eyes as she inhaled deeply. She was smelling me, as if I was a freshly baked meal, and when she tilted her face back towards me and snapped her eyes open, I expected her to bite my head off. But instead, she opened her jaws in what must have been a smile. Her broken, jagged yellow and black teeth were enough to shock me into falling backwards into the snow. The smell of rot and decay that emanated from her gaping maw made bile rise up in my throat. The monstrous old hag withdrew one of her arms from inside her ragged cloak and pointed a bony, elongated finger with a dagger-like yellow nail at me, and then looked up and pointed behind me. I realized she was pointing towards my apartment complex, and I snapped my head in the direction of where she was indicating, only to look back and find her gone. The rustling of her cloak in the darkness and the wide-spaced crunching footfalls in the snow told me she was racing towards my apartment, towards Allie, who was home alone. I screamed out, "No!" as I struggled to get up and run. I wasn't sure what I could do to stop the giant monster woman from taking my child, but I ran towards her anyway. I tripped a few times as I ran with only my dim light to guide me. As I made it to my apartment, I could see the tall, shadowy figure beginning to crouch down and look through the window to my daughter's room. The cheap apartment was worn down and in disrepair, so the only thing holding the window shut was a wooden broom handle. I watched as the giantess used her long, sharp nails to pluck away the screen and then pry into the window's edge and effortlessly slide it open while splintering the piece of wood that was supposed to hold it shut. Again, I was frozen in place as I watched this creature reach through Allie's window with a wrinkled giant hand and pluck her out of bed. Her blanket was still wrapped around her as she was dragged out, kicking and screaming into the cold, dark air. I don't know if I was shaking from the cold or from the fear, but I nearly dropped my phone as I pointed the light up at the ugly thing. The hooded creature turned to look at me while holding my daughter in its left hand. Its white eyes reflected the light from my phone, and I watched it open its impossibly huge mouth and bring my screaming daughter up to its face. I screamed and dropped my phone into the snow, plunging me back into total darkness. Just before everything went dark, I swear the tall, monstrous thing was smiling as it looked down at me and brought my child up towards its gaping line of rotting teeth. Despite my screams of protest and terror, I could still hear the sickening crunching of bones being mashed and masticated and the wails of agony from Allie as the monster devoured her right in front of me. I frantically searched for my phone in the snow, thinking that somehow I can still make things right if I could just find the light. My hands were numb with the cold, while the screaming and crunching sounds made me panic as I frantically felt around, hoping to see the light from my phone in the snow. I finally found it, just as the screaming stopped. I pointed the light up to where the monster was. It stood there facing me, with fresh blood dripping down her chin. She held my daughter's blanket in its right hand while picking its teeth with its left. It wore a smile of satisfaction as if it had just enjoyed a Christmas dinner. Again, I screamed, this time in anger and in sadness with the realization of what had just happened. The thing didn't react to my wails and instead took the blanket and used it as a napkin to dab at the blood dripping from her chin. Then, before I could react or do anything else, the wind whipped up and I was knocked back into the snow. It was a spontaneous blizzard with stinging winds and thick snow. I was once again lost in the darkness. I don't know how long I was tossed around in the unnatural storm, but when I came to, I was laying at the foot of my apartment door. My arms and legs were numb from the cold, but somehow I managed to get up and unlock my door. I rushed to my daughter's room and found her window open, and her bed empty. I was desperately hoping it had all been a dream. The wooden broom handle lay splintered on the floor and her blanket was missing. It felt like a nightmare. None of this felt like it could be happening. Yet, clearly, it all had. I collapsed to my knees and sobbed at the edge of my daughter's bed. I cried for what felt like hours, all the while asking, why? Pleading out loud that this has to be a bad dream. I didn't notice when the blackout ended, but the lights were back on when I heard a soft voice call out to me from behind me.
Mommy?
I slowly turned my head and saw Allie standing at the doorway to her bedroom. Or at least something pretending to be my Allie. Her skin was the color of ash and her eyes were the same milky white as the creature I saw in the snow. I blinked and her skin changed to a rosy pink and her eyes back to the light brown I remembered.
Mommy, are you okay?
She said. I only looked at her in disbelief. We looked at each other in silence for a few moments before I allowed myself to speak. You're not my Allie. She didn't react and instead only took a step forward.
What do you mean, Mommy? Yes, I am. I'm Allie,
she said politely. I shook my head no and answered her again. No, you're not. Allie is a spoiled brat. She's rude, she's misbehaved, and she never calls me Mommy. The thing pretending to be my daughter blinked at me a few times before finally answering.
You're right, Mommy. Allie was a bad girl. That's why the Gryla gobbled her up. That's why I'm here. I'll be a good girl. The best girl. I'm your Allie now, Mommy.
The next thing I remember, I was in a padded cell wearing wrist restraints. They said the police entered my apartment after a neighbor called when they heard me screaming, "You're not my daughter!" over and over again. They found me covered in blood, maniacally stabbing the thing pretending to be my daughter over and over again with my switchblade. But they didn't see it. Just before the thing died, just before I finished killing it, it smiled a rotten smile, and for a moment, its eyes turned back into a milky white lined with black veins. I'm not a very good mother. But I didn't kill my daughter. It was the Gryla. The Gryla came and ate my baby.
Number 2.
Robert Smith was my grandfather, and he was a hard man. He usually wasn't the sentimental or caring type, but I could tell he loved us by how protective he was of me and my siblings. Every winter, he made sure to buy us new coats or blankets, then grunt something along the lines of, "For the cold." During the holidays, he also insisted on cooking for the family, and despite his gruff and grumpy demeanor, we never complained, because he was a bit of a culinary genius. His holiday turkey and vegetable soups were just the thing we needed to, as he put it, warm the soul. When I say he was cold, I mean he was both outwardly cold, and it always felt like the room got colder while he was around. But still, we knew he did care about us, especially during the holidays. If you asked him to, he would tell you about the terrible things he saw and did during World War II. His monotone voice almost made it seem as if he was making it all up, but his medals and awards were hung up on his wall as a reminder of his service. I always assumed that the crazy things he experienced during war was the reason behind his outwardly cold demeanor, but last year on Christmas Eve, he shared a story that predated his time in the war. This was the first and last time he ever talked about it. I'll tell it as it was told to me.
Back when I was no older than 10 or 11, right in the middle of the Great Depression, I lived in a Catholic orphanage with about 200 or more other kids. I don't really care to remember the name of the orphanage, but what I do remember are the cold winters and the hunger we endured. There was never enough food to go around, and never enough money to keep the orphanage going, so the people running the place devised a plan. They would loan out a good number of us orphans to some of the factories in the area for some cheap labor, and thus make a little extra cash on the side to keep the orphanage running. A lot of us boys would come back injured or sick, if we even came back at all. Many disappeared or just ran away when they had a chance. Child labor was on the decline during those times, but not unheard of. My closest friend was a boy named James. He was about a year younger than me, but he was taller, and he knew how to scrap with the best of the older fellas. If there was ever a fight, your best bet was to put your earnings on him. We looked out for each other, and oftentimes would be sent out to the same factories to make money for the orphanage. They would always wake us up before the crack of dawn, and we'd be rushed out through the back with as many as 15 or 20 other boys, probably more. Sometimes we got loaded into the back of a truck with a delivery of supplies we'd have to unload at the factory we were going to. But more often, we just hoofed it through the snow. James and I both knew after the first few times that we'd better start keeping the old newspapers and using them to bundle up our feet so that we didn't end up losing any toes like some of the other kids did. Not all of us had shoes, and the ones who did were usually held together with string and twine. We'd start making cheap throwaway shoes for some of the other boys and sell them to them for a penny, with any spare newspapers and string we had left. A boy named Jimmy tried doing the same thing, but one cold morning, when they came for us, he just wouldn't wake up. His bed was empty by the time we came back from the factory. I still don't know if it was the cold or the fever that did him in. Probably both. But that happened to a lot of us. Most days we never saw the sun. We'd be up before sunrise and back after sunset. Some of the boys were so broken and calloused that they stopped talking. But James and I were each other's foundation. When he was too tired, I'd pick up the slack. And when I was too weak from hunger, he'd step in for me. We were like brothers. There wasn't a time that I wasn't hungrier or colder than the winter of 1930. Times were getting harder, and so the nuns that ran the orphanage were replaced by the new owners, and they more than doubled the number of kids going out to the factories. Yet despite having nearly 50 or more boys going out to different factories 6 days out of the week, we still never seemed to have enough earnings to feed everyone a proper supper. Cold, watered-down stew and small pieces of stale bread was usually a real treat for us. But most nights, we'd go to bed hungry. The new owners were meaner, more cruel than the nuns before them. They sold half the beds and nearly all of the linens. Boys were sharing beds or sleeping on the floors furthest away from the windows, just to try and stay warm. But every now and then, we would still find one or two that wouldn't wake up in the mornings. The worst part was how little we were eating. Like I said, a cold, watered-down stew or a small piece of stale bread was the most we would get. James and I were getting weaker and weaker by the day. However, Christmas Eve was coming up, and we were looking forward to the annual Christmas dinner to fill our bellies. All we had to do was hold out until then. Much of the factories were closed, observing the holidays. So, there were days where we weren't chosen to work, but no work meant less pay, and less pay meant less food. There were days leading up to Christmas Eve where we only ate snow from outside, just to strafe off the pain in our bellies. The nights leading up to Christmas Eve, I shared the floor with James. We were huddled up next to each other under a thin moth-eaten blanket to try and stay warm. I didn't know what was worse, the hunger pains or the shrill cold. But for James, it was the cold. For several hours, we shivered under the blanket, unable to sleep. James kept repeating the same two words. "I'm cold," he would say over and over again. At some point, James stopped shivering. But he continued to whisper the same two words every few minutes until the sun came up. Through the morning light, I was able to finally look over at him and see that he still had his eyes closed. I shook him to try and get him up, but when I touched him, he felt cold, too cold. He didn't respond to me when I called his name, yet I knew that just a few minutes ago, he had whispered that he was cold. Just as I was about to start calling out for help, I felt a strong hand grip my shoulder, and one of the caretakers flung me back against the wall. I told them James wasn't moving, that he wasn't waking up, but he didn't pay me any mind. He shook James harder than I did and got no response. I didn't want to believe that the boy I called my brother was dead, so maybe that's why I believed the next thing the caretaker said.
"He's fine, boy, just sick is all. We'll look after him."
As it turned out, 6 or 7 other boys didn't wake up that morning either. But the owners insisted that they were all fine, just sick as all, a bit of a cold, is all they would say. We were assured that all of them were being looked after, and there was nothing to worry about. I believed them, or maybe I just didn't want to believe that my best friend was gone. In the following days, we weren't sent to go work at the factories. And instead, we were given menial cleaning tasks. Yet, we were spared having to go outside and shovel the snow piling up by the side of the orphanage. Later, we attended regular religious studies by the fire, a much welcome distraction. It was strange that the owners finally lit the fireplaces for the first time in so long. More surprisingly, we received a pork stew for lunch, a meal we believed no longer existed for us, and then again for supper. For the first time, our bellies were full and the cold wasn't so bad. At least not until we went to sleep that night. The cold returned harsher than ever, and the snow seemed to fall faster and heavier than I have ever seen. The first night, the little sleep I got was filled with nightmares of a biting cold so fierce that it felt as if a cold shard of ice was carving up my flesh from my legs up. During the times that the biting cold kept me awake, I was shivering under my dirty thin sheet, listening to the wind howling outside. It sounded eerily like the cries of children suffering in the storm. Through the wind, I swore I could hear James calling out to me, begging me to help him, crying out that he was cold. The snow battering the windows sounded like the desperate fists of a child begging to be let in. The days leading up to Christmas Eve were all the same. Menial tasks during the day with warm meals we greedily ate up, and nights filled with terror from heavy snowfall and ghostly voices. The sleepless nights started to take a toll on my mind, and I began to hear James whispering through the halls, telling me that he was cold. The nightmares became more vivid and painful, causing me to wake up still feeling the stabbing pain from the cold in my legs. Each night, spreading further and further up until both of my thighs were hurting by morning's first light. I found out the grisly truth of what was happening on Christmas Eve. For several days, we had been treated to full meals and lit fireplaces. Yet the fire did little to warm us anymore, and the pork stew and ham we were served failed to bring any joy. The sleepless nights now brought on hallucinations of moving shadows at every corner, and James continued to whisper to me. I could see him, from the corner of my eye now and again, slipping through and between the moving shadows. We had just finished supper, and were off to bed, when James called out to me through the winds again. It was only a whisper, yet I heard him so clearly, it was as if he was standing right by me. I whipped my head around expecting to see him, but only saw an empty hallway leading away from the washroom. At the end of the dark hallway, I saw a shadow move, and for a brief moment, saw James looking back at me. The lack of sleep must have robbed me of some of my senses, and time, because before I knew it, my legs were carrying me down the hallway towards the dark. The wind continued to howl outside, and every window I passed rattled with the pounding snow and wind. Every step I took brought on a chill that seemed to stab me to the bone. Yet through the wind. I thought I still heard James calling to me. My walk through the dark orphanage led me to the kitchen, and James called my name, and again I heard the whisper over the wind and the pounding on the windows. As I walked through the dark kitchen, I could hear the door leading into the alleyway rattling from the wind and snow. It truly sounded as if there were crying children wailing on the other side, pounding against the heavy wood door and desperately begging to escape the cold. Despite the pitch darkness, I somehow could see every detail of the heavy door, and my slow steps towards it were marked with stinging, sharp slices of pain to my legs as the cold bit into me. 2 steps away from the door, I reached out and felt it vibrate with the force of the storm outside. It was cold to the touch, and the wailing in my ears was becoming unbearable, while the pain in my legs became almost crippling. My teeth chattered loudly, maybe more out of fear than from the chill. Yet I could hear James's voice calling just behind the door. No longer a whisper, but a loud cry of anguish. I reached for the latch and compulsively tugged at the door. It swung open, and I braced myself for the harsh wind and snow that I knew would sting my face. I nearly expected to see a flood of children pile in out of the cold and into the kitchen. I expected to see James tumble in with them. But instead, all I saw was snow. And the moment the door swung open, the howling and banging and storm all came to a sudden and abrupt halt. There was only the alleyway, with snow piled up to my knees. A path was carved out that led partway out into the alley, but no further. My legs now felt numb, and the silence left me feeling more unsettled than the howling that had now somehow gone silent. I no longer felt the cold, and almost all sensation left my body. But I knew it was still freezing, because the puffs of breath clouded in front of me. I was barefoot, but stepped into the alley and heard the sound of snow crunch beneath my naked foot. It was still dark, but I could see enough to know that there were unnatural shapes beneath the deep blanket of snow. I don't know why, but I started to dig. My arms and legs felt nothing as I scooped snow out of the way and dug down into the first shape, hidden only a yard from the kitchen door. It may have only taken moments, but it felt like an eternity to scoop away enough snow to find a familiar, naked figure hidden under the white blanket. James lay before me, stiff and unmoving, frozen in an eternal sleep, almost exactly the same as I last saw him. His legs, however, were stripped of all flesh, all the way down to the bone. There were many other shapes hidden beneath the snow in the alleyway, frozen and hidden out of sight. They were all the sleeping boys that never woke up. They were the boys claimed by the cold. They were the pork stew that was served to us for Christmas lunch and dinners leading up to the holiday.
Granddad shed a singular tear that Christmas Eve after telling us his story. It was the first and only time we ever saw him cry. Some events in the lives of others can leave them with a lasting chill that follows them everywhere they go. Granddad endured the coldest aspects of life, but always gave us the gift of warmth and a good meal. I think that on that Christmas day, he had finally received a gift he had been waiting for a long time. Warmth and peace, despite the cold horrors of this world that can leave you chilled to the bone.
Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to the Creepy Carousel Horror Podcast.
If you have any creepy content you want us to cover, feel free to email us at tjgzhorrorcast@gmail.com.
Happy nightmares, everyone.